Good morning. Mr. West and Mr. Coda are handing out a couple of pages of handouts for this morning. Please make sure you get a copy. There's two pages, front and back. Anyone else missing? Feel free to start having a look at those. In the meantime, I just have a few sort of administrative items to attend to as we get started. Written nicely on the board so I don't forget. The first thing is, based on a very high recommendation from the Thompson family, I'd like to see about the possibility of setting up a field trip to go see the Adams National Museum down in Quincy, Massachusetts. If, and meaning that a group of us could sort of get together, pick a day, travel down together, and go through the various tours and the different properties they have down there. I thought, and particularly based on their recommendation, I think it would be highly valuable for us to do so. So to that end, if anyone's interested, the cost is fairly minimal. It's about $5, maybe $10, depending on the type of pass you get. So the cost is fairly minimal. But if anyone's interested, if you can just sort of sign up at the end of the class, and I can coordinate when we would actually go down. A group of eight or more, they require some reservations, so just name, contact info, and a weekday or a weekend preference. I realize, what's that? They're open Sunday, or 7 days a week, 9 to 5. Okay. So, they do claim on the website that they get more traffic and be a lot busier and tours fill up faster on the weekends. For those who work during the week, obviously the weekend would be more beneficial. But if there's enough that the weekday would work out best, maybe we can do that as well. So if you can fill that out at the end of class, that would be great. If there are any other questions, just let me know. The second quick point, I've failed to mention that I have questions posted on the discussion board. Fortunately, there have been some people that have found that on their own, but I've been neglecting in mentioning that. So I would just encourage you, even if you don't participate, I certainly highly encourage you to participate, but even if you don't participate in the active discussion, at least have a look to see what sorts of things are going on there. As usual, there's always some interesting posts there. And thank you to James for continuing that. The third item is a little bit of disclosure. So some things I forgot to mention in my first class. One is I realized that I didn't include this in my list of resources, and I was rather neglectful. This is a series of lectures by Joseph Ellis, who's one of the authors that I've read most of in this area. And it's called The Brotherhood of the Revolution, and it's just a series of, 14 lectures. And so I have this available. If anyone's interested in borrowing the CDs, it's basically an overview of the whole generation, the whole time period that we're covering. And he certainly touches on Adams and Jefferson, but goes in details in other areas. The other item is a bit of a confession, and it's one that I had intended again to make in the first lesson, but I forgot. And that is that I actually have, between Adams and Jefferson, I personally have a favorite. And I wanted to confess that to you in the event that, despite my best efforts, in the event that I'm not particularly objective that you could call me out for it, or at least know where I'm coming from. Since I failed to inform you of that, I thought it might be interesting. Was it? Because that's, I'm curious to know, without me admitting, I think I've had conversations with some of you, so if you've had that conversation with me, I'd ask that you keep that to yourself. But just in the course of the, in the lessons thus far, if anyone could venture a guess as to whom I would personally favor. And if there's no guesses now, I'm going to leave that as it is. And if anyone has a guess in the future, obviously if you can give some evidence as to why I would prefer that person, it would help me understand if I'm being truly subjective as I am setting out to be. So before we move on, anyone have any guesses thus far on who I have a preference for?
Well, or we who all I probably all have our preferences too.
Right. So. Okay. So moving forward, if anyone thinks, based on how I'm presenting material, that you have a guess as to who my favorite is, let me know. So as far as today, so hopefully everyone received a handout, the two different pages of handouts. I thought today, as opposed to sort of continuing on with the history, dates, and times, and the events and those sorts of things, I thought it would make some sense to take a bit of a detour, or just camp out a little bit and have a look at some of the writings of Adams and Jefferson. I thought it made the most sense to look at, for Adams, thoughts on government, and for Jefferson, obviously, the Declaration of Independence. And the reason I felt these are probably the most appropriate to look at, these are probably their most influential writings, or the ones that had the most direct impact, both then and into the future. Certainly with Jefferson, I think it's fairly obvious, the Declaration, everyone knows that today. Thoughts on government a little bit more subtle, but I think very important for that time period. And so what I've done, I've just pulled various excerpts from both documents, as opposed to just listing it all out. And my plan isn't to necessarily go through each of these excerpts. You can certainly do that on your own time. And even if you really want, you can just do a quick search on the internet. You can pull up full text of these quite easily. But just to sort of highlight some different things that I found intriguing, and sort of pointing to, I think, where both gentlemen seem to be coming from. I would highly encourage, as you're reading through these, if you have any comments, anything strikes you as odd or particularly important, anything you'd like to share, please feel free to add to the class. The less I drone on, the better. So with that, I'd like to start with Adams' thoughts on government. One thing I hadn't really sunk into me until I was really sort of doing a little bit more background on the document. It was actually composed as a letter initially to, I believe, a fellow congressional delegate from, I believe it was North Carolina. He was heading back to help set up his state constitution and asked Adams for his views. So that's how it started. And then another delegate asked for a copy, and another delegate, and another delegate, and he was faithfully handwriting these things out, and then Richard Henry Lee decided, why don't we just print the thing? So that's how this document came to be spread around. And some of the key themes, the first one I'd like to point to is actually the very last one, so at the bottom of page 2. It just sort of shows Adams' appreciation, I think, for this particular moment in history And so if you, and this is actually at the close of the letter. You and I, my dear friend, have been sent into life at a time when the greatest lawgivers of antiquity would have wished to live. How few of the human race have ever enjoyed an opportunity of making an election of government, more than of air, soil, or climate, for themselves or their children. When, before the present epoch, had 3 millions of people full power and a fair opportunity to form and establish the wisest and happiest government that human wisdom can contrive. I hope you will avail yourself in your country of that extensive learning and indefatigable industry which you possess to assist her in the formation of the happiest governments and the best character of a great people. So that sort of gives a bit of a foundation for Adams' thought into what he was going through at that period in time. And as a reminder, this is in April of 1776. So this is certainly before the Declaration, but it's even before the resolution passes in May in the Continental Congress, stating that the individual colonies should assume their individual governments, institute new constitutions. So he's already got a sense of where history is headed. Does any of that statement strike anyone as odd or interesting or... How about that portion, opportunity to form and establish the wisest and happiest government that human wisdom can contrive? Does that strike anyone as odd, or is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
I think he was seen as a new slate that, in a very unique way that history hadn't allowed before, when you had monarchies or other things, there was always a leftover or a transition, but this was really a pretty wide open opportunity that was fairly unique to especially people of their class to have such a hands-on opportunity. I guess they, you know, in the past it would have been under the oversight of a monarch, or, you know, it would not have been with such liberty of expression, I guess, mm-hmm. as he saw.
Absolutely. I mean, up to this point, everyone, certainly there were different governments established in world history, but up to that point, everyone in America, they were born under British rule, under the monarch. This was an opportunity to decide what their government would look like. Mr. Eggert, sorry.
I think hindsight we have now, 200 years later, seeing how much has gone wrong, we are inclined to say, well, perhaps a more explicit statement of subordinating human wisdom to biblical revelation would be in order. I don't believe personally that, no matter how explicit you get, that it would change the heart of man just by the words itself. But that's an inclination that many of us would have. We would see a term like human wisdom, and they might rightly say, yeah, we mean human wisdom in interpreting the scriptures and applying them. But they didn't say that part. So we would be inclined now to say, we want to have human wisdom to understand God's fullest revelation and implement it as completely as possible.
It's an absolutely excellent point. That was actually the exact point I was going to. So thank you for bringing that up, because you did it much better than I probably would have. And it was just to that point that sort of particularly in with hindsight and today, there are critics of the Founding Fathers that would look at and sort of try and pick out certain phraseology that would lend itself to, see, they're just relying on human wisdom. And so I would posit more that Adams would be appropriately calling out human wisdom in relation to living out what the Bible calls out for government. even though he doesn't necessarily specifically state that in the phrase there. Did you have a point, Mr. West?
That first sentence is pretty neat too. He realizes that he was sent into the world at that time, mm-hmm. and he realizes that past lawgivers would relish that, starting with a brand new slave.
Absolutely. Mr. Harvey.
And I think on that same note, I think it's a great statement of how Adams and really all of the founding fathers really felt that they were engaged in something that was epic, that was really magnificent and of global significance. And I think in all American history, there's only maybe a couple of times when the people felt like that happened. I think World War II was maybe one time when Americans felt like something really great was going on, great in the sense of something of global significance. Mm-hmm. But I think the founders felt that the founding was something like that. And they continue to feel that way until the end of his days.
Right, yeah. Again, I find it that the most remarkable thing to me is sort of the timing of it. He's already envisioning that we're getting a chance to set up new governments, and no one's, I mean, in his circles, yeah, people are talking about independence, but it's certainly not a foregone conclusion at this point yet. But he's already sort of seeing that that's an eventuality. The some of the other items in there, I think the key thing that I would want to point out is what for Adams becomes kind of a lifelong sort of guiding principle for him is the idea or the principle of virtue. And if you look at on page one, the second excerpt under the on form of government, if there is a form of government, then, whose principle and foundation is virtue, will not every sober man acknowledge it better calculated to promote the general happiness than any other form? And so this is really getting at the heart of where Adams sees virtue, and as he would see it, the ability to do what is right, to do the right thing, even in the face of either unpopular opinion, or in the face of popular opinion at the time, or what might be easy or convenient. So I feel like that's certainly something we can certainly grab a hold of, and something that unfortunately is missing in many of our politicians today. He certainly, within this, advocates and talks about the best form of government, and he certainly spells it out quite clearly that he feels that a republic is the best. And the reason for that, he says, is ultimately it's a republic is an empire of laws and not of men. He makes a quote, I'm not sure who that's of. But the idea, and particularly for Adams, as the law is very important to him, but so we can see that's a very foundational concept that no one is above the law. Everyone is subject to the same law. And he spells out various checks and balances that we have now become familiar with, but no one at that time had really articulated or argued the sort of the benefits or the reasons for that. But it's sort of interesting because certainly he's writing and talking to various people at this time, but there's an interesting letter at this time from Abigail Adams to John that sort of speaks to not only Abigail's ability to understand the times as well as, if not in some cases, better than some other men at that time. But also sort of that between John and Abigail, with that correspondence, John had somebody that he could relate to, he could discuss these things, and he could be influenced, I think, in a positive way by her. And this is around the same time, this is a letter from Abigail to John. "I am more and more convinced that man is a dangerous creature, and that power, whether vested in many or few, is ever grasping. The great fish swallow up the small, and he who is most strenuous for the rights of the people, when vested with power, is as eager after the prerogatives of government. You tell me of degrees of perfection to which human nature is capable of arriving, and I believe it, but at the same time, lament that our admiration should arise from the scarcity of the instances." Scarcity of the instances.
Look at the man's wisdom in isolation, but then if you look at the fact that he and his wife had this dynamic, high-level discourse ongoing, you really see the power of the that God has established in marriage and ultimately appoints to the Jesus in the church. He embodied far more than forms of government in his relationship with Abigail.
Mm. Absolutely. That's an excellent point.
I can't see Jefferson having that same discussion with a wife.
Yeah. And so, based on those sorts of discussions, certainly he had with Abigail and others, he certainly frames the government, or argues for a government, with appropriate checks and balances. And he makes arguments, and I'll leave these for you to read on your own. Again, these are just excerpts, but he really argues, first of all, that you need a representative assembly, but you can't invest all the powers in that one representative assembly. And he goes on to argue and make the case regarding having the distinct branches of government, legislative, executive, and an independent judiciary. The fact that the legislature should be bicameral, he argues for. Interesting on the judiciary, he does make some statements there. Sort of the second statement on the second page on the judiciary. He did argue strongly for the fact that he felt that the judges should hold offices for life, or at least, as it says, in other words, their commission should be during good behavior. In other words, if it is found that they are not upholding their office and administering justice appropriately, that they should be impeached and removed. But he does hold to that all through his life. It begins here, and he holds that even through the Constitution. He makes a pretty strong statement on education there as well. "Laws for the liberal education of youth, especially of the lower class of people, are so extremely wise and useful that to a humane and generous mind, no expense for this purpose would be thought extravagant."
You may regret that statement.
Precisely why I put that in there. It's sort of interesting, if you were to take that statement, there are some that would argue that Adams would be in favor of the wanton spending that occurs nowadays in the funding of the public school system. But I have a feeling, given his frugality, that such spending would actually be horrifying to Adams.
I think he was in a whole different realm at that point of his liberalness in spending is would have a control on it that we would find today to be quite austere.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Trager.
I think John is certainly correct. I think that this is one of the great advances that we can say that we've made in the recent centuries, because now most Christians would see education in and of itself isn't some neutral entity floating about that we just need to get more of. We need education that is correct in its presuppositions. And these things have been recently articulated by our people, like Van Til and Rushdoony and people like that, have made this very clear. They've coined this term, the myth of neutrality. That would have been helpful for Adams to have this information, this new insight. He didn't have it. He simply said education is what we need. It's a good thing. Let's get it.
Mm-hmm.
And today we could point out that, well, Adolf Hitler was surrounded by some of the most highly educated people of any national government ever.
Sure. Well, he favored education as well, but only education that was strictly controlled by himself.
Sure, yes. Sure.
And in a particular direction, a wide open, you know, look at a bunch of things and you know, learn what you're interested in. Somebody else learns what they're interested in, but rather Hitler and the socialists as well have determined that, no, you got to study.
This is what you need to study.
What everybody else studies, mm-hmm. and you've got to be right down the line with all of us.
Mm-hmm. But it's important to establish there's no neutrality in education.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I don't know if the statement of Adams means what we would think it would mean today.
Mm-hmm.
Say we have the Department of Education. That came in 1980. It didn't come in 1780.
Yep.
I mean, and the, I think maybe when he's talking about spending on education, how much money did Washington, D.C. spend on education during that time?
No,
you know, I think basically zero. So it may have been outside of the governmental sphere that
sure.
he's talking about, really, civil government.
Well, he is speaking to the forms of government, but I think important to that education, both for Jefferson and Adams, but speaking specifically to Adams making this statement, they really relished the opportunity to receive the education they received, and you can see in that they're interested in getting that opportunity for others, I think, more so than the government needs to absolutely fund.
I was just going to say that I think all of the statements are saying Adams assumed wrongly, I think, that in our nation the laws for a liberal education were going to have a biblical worldview as a basis. And you know, I don't think he foresaw what would come after that. I mean, I think he thought the reason that he wanted a republic is because the republic would be run by Christians, moral people. And, you know, like Mr. Egger said, education is not neutral. You think of both Adams and Jefferson, they relished their education. They relished learning. They learned on their own,
mm-hmm.
and that's why it was, and they sacrificed in order to learn. You know, in different realms. I think Jefferson was more of a scientist, and Adams, you know, like if we were gonna summarize them, he, you know, Adams was more the law, the
mm-hmm.
lawyer digging into natural law, and I think it was Blackstone that he read a lot of, and that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and he thought that everyone should have that opportunity, you know, not necessarily an opportunity to just learn whatever you want to learn.
James?
I don't think we actually need to speculate as much on this. I think Adams was pretty clear because he and his contemporaries supported the Constitution, which was drafted, which says all powers not specifically enumerated to the federal government are reserved to the states and the people. And so if education was not put in there under the federal sort of tent, we know for a fact they did not support a federally mandated education system.
Yes.
So
very well.
Very, very good summary. Thank you. That is excellent. So I think some of these excerpts I pulled out specifically hoping to garner some of this conversation. I think it speaks to the danger that you can have in sort of taking excerpts and trying to sometimes extrapolating meaning that may not have been there in the original intent. But at any rate, hopefully you found that helpful. Again, if you're interested in reading the whole thing in context, it's available on, just do a quick Google search. You can get the full text very easily. Mr. Hardy.
Can I just say something on a different point? I think the most interesting thing in these Adams comments is the statement that he defines a republic as an empire of laws, not of men. And that's something that I think is profound. I think it's profoundly Christian. You know, we're people who believe that we have the very word of God. Muhammad called us people of the book. And if you look at the long sweep of Western civilization, going back to the Magna Carta and up until this time, it was a struggle to get across the point that government is answerable to a higher law, and that kings even are subject to the law. And that's something that we tend to take for granted, but it doesn't automatically happen. Back in Adam's time, there was certainly the idea that the law is whatever the king says it is. And today, in our own age, what we've been sort of corrupted to where people make a cult out of democracy, and they feel that whatever the people want is to be held as sacred. Mm-hmm. And it's in effect the same thing as what the divine right of kings argument of centuries ago. But the Christian idea, and the thing that's so profoundly Christian about the founders, is that constitution that James was talking about, and the fact that we were elevating the law and saying that we were going to be a nation of laws. And I think that on the point about the judiciary and the fact that Adams wanted judges in office for life, that particular check was so that we would be a nation of laws, so that because the legislative branch is supposed to be the branch that articulates the will of the people, but we don't want to, you know, we don't believe that the people are God. They're still themselves subject to the laws, and you need to have lifetime officials who can hold people accountable. And Adams felt that it was necessary for judges to have that tenure so that they could do that and make sure that we remained faithful to the law.
Mike, may I comment on that?
Absolutely.
I really agree with what John said. I think the original quote here might be a Samuel Rutherford, an empire of laws and not of men. He was the one who wrote that book, Lex Rex, which means the law is king. But I think we have to be careful to not use the term law in the same way that we talked about education. Law does not exist as an abstraction, some entity that we just need to get more of, and the more we get, the better we are. There are good laws and bad laws. And I think what we might want to say today as Christians is that we have an advantage that John Adams didn't have. We have several centuries of learning. And we would be inclined now to say an empire of transcendent, revealed, biblical law is what we need. Those are the kind of laws we want. We don't want laws like Roe v. Wade, which is law. Mm-hmm. That's law.
Sure.
So we don't want to be just sitting here admiring law as an abstract concept in and of itself. We want to go further and say what kind of law, and make that as explicit as we can, with all the risks inherent in doing that.
I'm sure.
I know there's a lot of interpretation problems and things like that, but let's get into those problems. Let's wonder, let's debate, how do we apply the Sixth Commandment to the question of abortion? And there may be some variation. There may be good Christian people that might hash that out, and there might be some real problems of articulation. But let's get into those with at least the Sixth Commandment as the basis for the discussion, rather than just let's get into, say, we need law.
Sure.
two or three minutes with Thomas Jefferson?
That's right.
We know who your favorite is.
Or is he just next week?
I think in the interest of time, I think I will shift Jefferson to next week, so we can...
Yes, while you're choosing a field trip to Adams...
Virginia's further away. Yeah.
Thank you, Mrs. West. Did you have a...
I just wanted to say, when Mr. Hunter says that, I just remember a sermon that he did a long time ago, and the whole term epistemological self-consciousness, it seems like we really have to be self-conscious, and I'm not always, but I think maybe he should do the sermon again and reteach us that, it's not just, our life is not just abstract. We have a purpose. Mm-hmm. We have a goal in mind.
All right. Well, with that, I think we'll close a little early, and we'll finish up with start off with the declaration next week. Any final comments before we close in prayer?
Is it right that your family roots are in Quincy and Burns?
Can I guess now?
If it's merely a guess at this point. Mr. Gupta, would you mind closing us in prayer?
Sure. Heavenly Father, we are grateful, Lord God, that you have provided the wisdom to Ryan to